Tonight I'd like to talk about some aspects of mindfulness practice. Mindfulness is an aspect of the mind, an aspect of our mental functioning. Thoughts, memories, these are other aspects of the mind. What distinguishes mindfulness is that it's the quality of observing, paying attention to, without labeling, but directly knowing what is going on. So when we watch the breath, we are experiencing the breath directly when we feel the touch of the breath, without the concept I am breathing, but just knowing the breath in and out. As it moves, it touches, produces a feeling. Without identifying my breath, but just breath. Mindfulness has this quality of attention that goes back to the direct reality of what's happening, without the concepts, without the interpretations. This is a nice breath. I like this breath. This is so pleasant. Or, where's my breath gone? So it's the direct experience of the breath, and when we apply it to our whole experience of being, this is when we say that we are developing the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness are the four places that the Buddha said that we need to focus our attention, this witnessing quality of the mind, this observing quality of attention, in order to be able to see clearly what experience is. Before we interpret that experience as being me and mine. And mindfulness is one of the most important aspects of the practice that we do in Buddhism, developing this witnessing, observing aspect of the mind. And these four focuses for our attention are all within our own mind and body. So during the meditation, when you were observing the breath, you were observing an aspect of the body. When I asked you to, as soon as you noticed that the mind has wandered away, then you were observing one of the mental objects that had arisen, something that you were aware of, either a thought or a sense contact. Where was the mind when it wasn't paying attention to the breath? And then at the end of the meditation, when I asked you to observe what was the quality of the mind, whether it was sharp or whether it was fuzzy, this was the quality of attention, the quality of the mind itself, that was being mindful. So the focuses of attention outlined by the Buddha in the teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness cover the body itself, not just the breath, but various aspects of paying attention to the body, and various aspects of paying attention to the mind. The kind of mind that is paying attention. The kind of mind that is paying attention, and then what happens in the mind that is paying attention. What is produced when the mind pays attention to a sound, for example. What is produced very often is a whole series of thoughts about that sound. Identifying what the sound is, deciding whether it's a good sound or a bad sound, whether we like it or don't like it, whether we've heard it before, what it means, whether we want more of it. This whole process is triggered by hearing a sound. And the purpose of paying attention to these four focuses of attention within the mind and within the body is to start to see how our experience, moment by moment by moment, arises. What produces it? What produces I like and I don't like? What produces I want more, I don't want that? What makes me speak? What determines how I speak and what I say? With our wrong understanding, we think, we assume, we have the wrong view that there is someone in here, me, who is directing our life, directing our experience, pulling the strings, making things happen, choosing to act in this way, choosing to think in this way, choosing to speak in this way. That's me. That's who I am. And this sense of self, this sense of who we are, the Buddha said, is a wrong understanding of what is actually a process of cause and effect. One thing leads to another in a process of constant interaction. Interaction between our own mind and body, interaction between our mind and body and what we experience in the world, interaction between what is happening in the present and what we've experienced in the past, our conditioning, our habit patterns. And that all of these things are produced phenomena. None of them is who we really are. It's a combination of influences, events, conditions, circumstances that are interacting in different ways, producing different results at different times, which themselves then become new causes for producing the next part of the process. So, for example, while you're sitting here and watching the breath, if you're familiar with this practice, if you've developed this practice, then the mind likes to watch the breath. And it's happy to watch the breath. And when the instruction is given to watch the breath, that instruction, that sound contact, produces a pleasant feeling in the mind. Ah, I like to do this. And so because the mind likes to watch the breath, then it takes up the breath with a feeling of pleasure. And with that feeling of pleasure, there's this capacity to hold the attention on the breath because I'm doing something that I like. And even if other sounds arise in the environment, even if there's an ache in the leg, that's okay, I'll stick with the breath because I like the breath. Now, if one isn't used to this practice and hasn't experienced a peaceful feeling in the past arising from watching the breath, then the instruction, now we're going to watch the breath, will produce a different reaction in the mind. Even if we want to watch the breath, because we've been told it's good to watch the breath, it'll be good for you, it'll help you to be peaceful, it'll relieve your stress, we might have all sorts of good reasons for wanting to watch the breath, but because of our experience so far, that it hasn't been so easy, we haven't found it pleasant, then the instruction that we're going to watch the breath will produce a different kind of reaction in the mind. And that reaction to the instruction will produce a different kind of reaction to watching the breath. And we might find that if we don't like watching the breath, that that actually makes the breath coarser. That mental attitude produces a coarser breath. Whereas we'll notice that when we are very peaceful and when we like watching the breath very quickly becomes smooth, easy, soft. So our mental state has affected the state of our body, that is the breath. And we'll notice that if we persist with this meditation practice and the mind calms down, the breath will automatically also calm down. So we see the interaction between our own mind and our own body. When the mind relaxes, the breath calms. When the mind is calm, the body also relaxes. And if we're sitting here and we're enjoying watching the breath, it doesn't matter if there's noise around us because we've got a pleasant feeling going in our own mind and body. Doesn't matter if there's an ache in the knee, we've got something nice to stick with, to hold on to. And so we stay focused internally on ourselves. Let the world go away. Doesn't matter what happens out there, it's fine. But if we are experiencing difficulty in settling on the breath, if the mind is already having difficulty holding on for a couple of breaths, then there will be already a slight feeling of dis-ease, unpleasant feeling. And then if there's a noise around us, and that noise makes it even more difficult to hang on to the breath, then that unpleasant feeling will grow. And we will notice that very easily we lose attention on the breath. The breath goes out to engage in the world because the unpleasant feeling that has arisen within us is amplified by the noise that we hear at a time when we don't want to hear it. And so our reaction is unpleasant. And that, in turn, increases the unpleasant feeling that we have in our own mind already. So we notice the interaction between our own mind and body and what we experience in the world, from the world, through the five sense doors. Hearing is just one of those doors. And depending on what we experience and how we react to it, we start to create a whole chain of cause and effect. So the more we don't like something, the more we might pick it up and play with it, because it matches up to the state, our inner state, when we come in contact with it. And if we don't have something to turn towards so that we can drop that thing, we might find that we play with it moment after moment after moment. So this is what happens when we're trying to watch the breath and the mind gets carried away with thinking, for example. We're watching the breath and out of nowhere comes a thought about something that happened yesterday. Where did that thought come from? It just arose. It's not that we asked it to come. It's not that we wanted it to be there. We weren't looking for that thought. It just came. There was a moment when there wasn't full attention on the meditation object that created a space in the mind and a thought arose. Now, if we have our attention focused on the breath, and particularly if there's a pleasant feeling going along with that, we'll notice that we're not interested in that thought. We might be initially interested because that thought came up, but we're not wanting to continue it, to keep on playing with it. We've got something better to do, so we let it go. But if our mind isn't settled, or if that particular thought is something that we think is really important or interesting, or better than what we've got when we're watching the breath, then we can very easily shift our attention, maybe without even realizing it, onto that thought. And before we know it, we've wasted minutes going over something from the past or projecting something into the future that hasn't happened yet. So we can notice cause and effect in this kind of experience. Depending on the state of the mind that receives that thought, we can pick it up or we can put it down. If the mind is very settled and calm, even a thought that might be emotionally charged, we may be able to just notice and put it down. But if the mind is already anxious or disturbed, then a thought that comes up that carries with it a strong emotion can easily sweep us away. We can actually take up that emotional reaction triggered by that thought and find that emotion being produced in our mind right in the present moment. Even if it was something from the past that happened a long time ago, something that we thought was finished, if the mind is susceptible, then we can start it all over again. And it's just like we were back there right now. This is the way our experience is produced. Constant process of cause and effect. Now, mindfulness is developed in order to be able to observe this very process, to cut through the wrong view of self, which thinks that we chose that thought that came into the mind, that we're in control of what kind of reactions we have when something comes into our environment. That we are running the show. If you observed as you were trying to watch the breath, just wanting to watch the breath doesn't make it happen. You have to produce the conditions for being able to sustain your attention on the breath. Part of those conditions is the state of the mind that you start with. Part of those conditions is the desire to keep your attention on the breath. Part of those conditions are what's going on around you. And part of those conditions is practicing it again and again and again. We see that just wanting, in that particular instance, it's a very simple thing, trying to focus one's attention on one thing that we choose, that we're not actually in control of the mind. And mindfulness is developing the ability to start witnessing that moment by moment by moment, to see what produces our experience and how we have this wrong understanding of a self, of a me that is in here, in this mind and body somewhere, controlling the whole show. The mindfulness is developed in order to be able to identify this process. Identify the process of the body and identify the process of the mind to see how they interact and to see how they interact with the world out there. And in the teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha gives various exercises, various different ways of approaching this. So in looking at the body, we have this sense that this body is me. And the Buddha says, well, which part of it is me? Is it the part on the outside that you can see? What about the parts inside that actually are essential for continued life? The parts that we don't normally have access to directly, like the liver and the kidneys and the intestines. Is that me? And am I in control of that part of the body? What about the parts of the body that I don't like to think about, like the intestines or the feces that comes out of the body? Is that me? Is that mine? When does it become me and when does it cease being me? This is one of the exercises that the Buddha encourages us to engage in to unravel this wrong view of me. And when we think, well, no, the body's not me, but the mind is me, my experiences, my memories, my history, then we focus on how we produce our experience in the present moment. And we'll notice how even moment by moment our reactions change, let alone day by day by day. So the same thing can have produced quite different reactions within us depending on what's going on today compared to yesterday. We see something that we like, that we enjoy today, and tomorrow, because we're in a bad mood or we've got something pressing on our mind or we're feeling particularly tired, that same thing doesn't produce the same reaction. We see that this mind, which we take to be me, which we think of as constant, as substantial, is also in a state of flux and flow, is produced by causes and conditions. And we have to keep on investigating in order to break through the delusion of self. So the ability to observe our reactions rather than getting swept away by our reactions, to notice what happens to change our moods, what happens to change our mind, to start to see things that influence our experience and our experience of who we think we are. We can directly take up for investigation something that we think is who we are. We might think, I'm a very kind person. And then we try to notice every time kindness is present in our experience. And we might start to see how conditional our kindness is. Sometimes it's too inconvenient to be kind. What happens then? So as well as looking at the kind behaviours, we look at when is it that it's difficult to be kind? What is it that produces kindness? Because certainly that's one of the qualities that I manifest. But what happens to produce lack of kindness? Sometimes we like to keep our eyes closed to the bits that we don't like, and so we never discover what produces those kinds of behaviours. Or we might have a particular way of looking at things where we only see when we're not kind. We never give ourselves credit for being kind. So we start to investigate that. Is it true that I'm not a kind person? So taking up just one aspect of our behaviour can be very interesting because we can start to look in areas of our life that we don't like to look at or that we may have been blocking out because they don't fit into our view of who we are, our view of self. So this quality of mindfulness that is able to look in a dispassionate way, not choosing the bits that we like, not pushing away the bits that we don't like, but keeping our eyes open for whatever is arising, as it's arising, without judgment, just knowing. And we have to do this again and again and again. And what strengthens this ability to be a detached observer of our experience is this simple practice of paying attention to the breath. We're paying attention to the breath just as it is. We're trying to pay attention to it continuously in all of its aspects, without fiddling with the breath, without wishing the breath were something else, just paying attention as it arises, as it passes away. Strengthening that ability to observe with detachment, without judgment, paying attention moment after moment after moment. So the meditation practice is very important to develop the skill of mindfulness. And what happens when we have mindfulness firmly established is that we're able to refrain from acting habitually. We have space between the arising of a mood, a thought, an emotion, a word that we're about to say, before we actually say it or do it. We develop a space in the mind from which we can choose how we're going to react. Because through mindfulness, we start to see the results of the way we've been thinking, the way we've been speaking, the way we've been acting. And we become more discerning about what's really useful and what's not. What's really appropriate and what's not. So, for example, we might wake up in the morning and for whatever reason we feel sad. Now, before we established mindfulness and were aware that moods come and go and that certain experiences, certain influences in our day produce different kinds of moods, when we wake up feeling sad, we immediately identify with, oh, I feel sad. I feel sad. I'm a sad person. This is going to be a sad day. And that is a sad day because I am sad. Now, if we have been practicing mindfulness and we know that moods come and go, they're produced by causes and conditions, instead of being a sad person, we can notice sadness is present this morning. What does that feel like? Yes, it has a feeling, a mental feeling. It expresses itself in the body in a particular way. Sadness, isn't that interesting? I wonder where that came from. Who knows? Oh well, just part of the passing show. Not me, not mine, not a self. Sadness, if I pay attention to it, if I play with it, will certainly grow. If I acknowledge it, am kind to it, leave it alone, then it will pass away. So instead of being completely engaged, enthralled, overwhelmed by sadness, we know sadness, we acknowledge sadness, and then we move on. And if we have sadness as a strong feeling in the morning, then we can counteract that by generating some thoughts that are not sad, that are to do with happiness, to do with contentment, to do with what I've got in my life. We can pay attention to what we have to do so that our mind is completely focused on the activities of the body. This is another one of the focuses for our attention that the Buddha outlined in the Satipatthana Sutta. And by giving our mind that object to pay attention to, then we give no room for sadness to roost in the mind. So we start to be able to decide what kinds of thoughts we're going to allow in, what thoughts we're going to allow to stay. And as we do this, as we become more skillful at it, we start to change the way we experience life. Remembering that the way that we feel is going to affect the way that we interact with the world. Not only what we put out into the world, but how we interpret and receive what we experience from the world. In these four focuses of mindfulness, the Buddha says that we should be focusing within our own mind and body most of the time. But in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha also mentions that from time to time, we need to pay attention to what's happening in other people. This is called external mindfulness compared to internal mindfulness. And this external mindfulness is not so that we can start to suss other people out and really get a handle on who other people are and what's going on for them, but so that we can start to see that what is true for me is also true for others. So if we take the body, for example, and we notice that this body functions according to the laws of nature, not according to my wishes, we understand that we get sick. If we're tired, if we don't get enough sleep, that affects us. If we've had too much to drink, that affects us. All those sorts of things. We start to see that this body is subject to causes and conditions. And then we start to observe that in other people. That other people get sick. Other people get old. Other people don't look too good today, depending on what they've been doing with themselves. And then we start to notice how what's happening in the body has an effect on the mind. We notice that if we don't get enough sleep, that that can produce a bad mood the next day. And then we might notice that that's the same for other people too. That what's going on in their body affects their moods, affects their mind. And so we see that what is true for me is true for others as well. The whole point of external mindfulness is to recognize the universality of the things that we are discovering in our own experience. Now, what we've discovered through our own practice is that different conditions produce different reactions within us depending on what kind of conditions are coming together at any one time, and depending on what we have experienced as part of our personal history. So, for example, I might love dogs because I've always had a good experience with dogs. And someone else might be terrified of dogs because they've been mauled by a dog in the past. Now, when I see a dog, or when I hear the bark of a dog, it produces a pleasant feeling within me. And I immediately think a happy thought about dogs. And I think, I'd love to see that dog. I wonder where it is. And I might actually go and get the dog to come and play with me. And the person next to me, who's had a frightening experience with dogs, just the sound of the dog barking produces an unpleasant feeling within them, before they've even realised that the dog's outside and it's not coming in, or that the dog's only a little dog and it's not harmful. Because of a past experience, just the sound of the dog produces an unpleasant reaction and an I don't like it and perhaps I'm afraid, get me out of here. So two people experiencing the same thing have completely different reactions. Now, when we've been watching ourselves long enough and we start to see how subject we are to the influences that we've been under so far in our life, or that we are under at this moment, and how they interact to produce our reactions in the present moment, as we really understand that in our own life, then we can see that that's how it is for other people. And that as we see that sometimes we're not actually choosing our reactions right now. It's just old habit patterns that are playing themselves out. And sometimes those old habit patterns are ones I wish I could get rid of. I don't like them. And yet, here it is again. As we see that in ourselves, then we're able to become more tolerant of it in other people. And also, not to assume any longer that we know exactly what another person is like, or what they're thinking, or why they're like that. Because we don't know another person's experience. We can infer from observation, we can assume from some things we know, we can make some guesses, but we can never really accurately know what life is like for another person. So again, we can become more tolerant, more compassionate, more understanding when we realize how experience is produced. And when we understand that it's only when we start to understand how experience is produced that we then have the possibility of doing something to change those things which aren't helpful. Now, watching other people or looking at other people, the Buddha said we should do only about 10% of the time. 90% of the time we should be looking at ourselves. But when we observe other people, we might see things in them that we start to notice in ourselves. Maybe something that we don't like. That person always wants to get to the head of the queue. And then we notice, well, or we might ask ourselves, well, do I do that? Am I that pushy kind of person? If I don't like it in them, then maybe I should do something about it in myself. So we use what we've observed in others to ask ourselves, is that how I am? Is that how I behave? Or I only behave that way in certain circumstances. What are they? What happens when I do that? Or alternatively, we may look at someone and think, gee, that person seems so calm and peaceful. How did they get to be like that? What can I learn from that person? What is it that I see in someone else that I might aspire to develop in myself? And what conditions, what influences do I need to develop in my own mind, in my own life, in order to be able to behave in that way? So looking out at others, again, is to help us to manifest within ourselves the kind of mind, the kind of life that leads to happiness and peace. Not to become judgmental about others, not to become critical of ourselves because we don't have that, or we can't do that yet, but to see what we need to work on, what we need to develop, and what we need to let go of. These are aspects of mindfulness which start from very humble beginnings, just being able to focus on the breath in a non-judgmental, detached witnessing way allows us little by little to gradually start to use that same quality of attention on our body, on our mind, on our moment-to-moment experience, so we can see more clearly things as they are, let go of what needs to be let go of, and develop what needs to be cultivated. I hope this teaching has been of benefit for you, and may this merit help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to answer them. The question is that when this person is meditating, they tend not to concentrate on the breath, but to concentrate on the energy in the body. Is that useful? When you say you're concentrating on the energy in the body, what exactly are you aware of? Right, okay. So you're focusing on sensation. So, yeah. So what we're trying to do with the practice is not to have a concept of anything like snow on the TV in the mind, but to be the direct experience of what is going on. And that can be a useful meditation object. That's paying attention to the body. So that is one of the four foundations of mindfulness. Paying attention to the breath is paying attention to one specific aspect of the body. The advantage of paying attention to the breath is that it's a narrow focus of attention, and eventually what we're trying to do is to move our attention to a very narrow focus. And if we pay attention to the whole body as the only aspect of the body that we focus on, then the attention tends to stay quite diffuse rather than coming to one point. So that kind of attention on the whole body is useful to bring the mind into the present moment. It's very, very helpful, and to keep it focused on something that is actually happening in the present moment. And once you've established that stability of mind, then it's useful to go to the breath and see whether you can establish that same kind of stability on a narrower focus. Right, that's a very good question. The question is about that we've learned a lot of things which seem, when we practice mindfulness, to just be arbitrary responses. And so is it the aim to dispose of all those arbitrary responses and respond in a fresh way every time? It's both. You see, we have learned certain things that are useful, and it's not a matter of throwing away all our experience and saying this is no longer useful because it's something that I learned before. But it's being able to know whether what we've learned in the past is relevant now. And that's what we don't have the capacity to do when we're just acting according to our habits and our previous experience. It colours our reaction in the present moment so much that the present becomes the past. And what we're trying to do is use what's we've learned that has been useful and apply it in the present moment, but in a way that is relevant, accurate. And if we understand that all of these things are arbitrary, then we can choose in the moment whether it's appropriate or not. So part of what we're doing is to see that we don't actually respond freshly in the present moment. The past colours our present reaction whether we like it or not. And in terms of the Buddha's teaching and the four foundations of mindfulness, this is Vedana. Vedana is the direct experience of what we've come in contact with. And it's totally conditioned by what we've experienced with that thing or something like it in the past. And that will arise whether we like it or not. The practice makes it possible to recognise that this has arisen, but is it now relevant? Is it appropriate in this situation? So, for example, for the person who's been mauled by the dog, the gut reaction, if you like, is unpleasant. But then the mind has the possibility with practice to recognise this is the old reaction, that's okay, but it's not really appropriate with this little dog, this fluffy little thing that's coming around wanting to lick my hand. And at that time, we can't just willfully push that old reaction away. We allow it to be there, but we respond in a different way in the present moment. Now, taking it to an absurd extent would be that we know that dogs have been ferocious in the past, and any ferocious dog we see now, we don't react with wisdom with it. We don't be cautious with it because we think we've got to just put all our old reactions away. That's not what we're saying at all. But giving ourselves the possibility of choosing our reaction in the present moment. People who have no control over their mind, who are insane, are they still relevant to Buddhism? I was probably more as Buddhism relevant to them. The Buddha would say that we're all a little bit insane. That's what we start to see when we watch our mind and see how out of control it is. It's more or less out of control. We are, all of us probably are able to present ourselves in daily life as being quite in control, but when we observe the mind in meditation, we see how it's often running riot, and we can't just through willpower stop it. So in order to practice this path, we have to have a certain level of sanity, of a certain level of the ability to be able to observe our mind and not to be completely swept up by the thoughts and emotions that arise in the mind. So it's a continuum, and a person who is insane would be a person who is completely believing all of their thoughts, completely believing all of their emotions as being absolutely true, and that they don't have any space in the mind to consider whether or not these are true and whether they're suitable and whether they're helpful for their happiness. So in that case, the Buddha would say that that person would be unable to practice this particular practice until their mind comes to that point. And we can all see that it's hard enough with a relatively sane mind to do this work. So it's not a matter of those people are not acceptable on a moral level or because of values. We don't like those people because of this or that. It's just that it's difficult for anyone with a mind that they believe completely as being the truth to do this work. It's impossible for anyone to say, because we don't know whether that person's receiving the fruits of a karma which is going to play itself out. We don't know what kind of thoughts are going to be present in their mind at any time. We don't know what kind of thought is going to be present at the time of their death, which is what will determine their future rebirth. So it's just speculation. We might just as well say, well, what's the person next to me's life going to be like in the future? We don't know. We don't know what ours is going to be until we see what the last moment of this life is. Sometimes we have things in our life which we can't really do anything about to change it. We just have to bear with it. We all experience things in our life that we'd like to be have differently, and we can't do anything with it. We just have to accept it and bear with it. And mental illness can be like that, but it can also be an episode in a person's life which doesn't recur. So we're in no position to judge. So I think enough. So I'd like to ask Sol to come up and make the announcement.